I've been asked to come and speak with you today about my son. His name was Shmuel Weiss, and he he fell 10 years ago. Chavav Nisan, Tavshin Samach Bet, in a city which is mentioned in the Tanakh in Sefer Yehoshua as Ir Ganim. Today it is called by the Arabs Jenin, and for some reason we continue to call it Jenin. I want to start my story at a point near the end, my son's story. Chavav Nisan, it's a few days after Pesach. At that time I was teaching in the old city, and the students hadn't come back yet from Chufshat Pesach, but I live in Kiryat Arba. But I went into Yerushalayim, I had my office, and I had some administrative work to do. Worked as usual. There was a minyan in Beit Knesset HaRamban in the old city at 1:15. I went to Devin Mincha. When I walked into the minyan, I felt and sensed some people staring at me. And I even heard one man say, not to me, someone standing next to him, what's he doing here? But I came to Davin, so I continued Davining. I went back to the school where I was teaching after Mincha. And when I walked into my office, I noticed that the secretary was crying. But I went into my office, and the secretary told me that I had a telephone call from my wife and I should take it in my room. I sat down, picked up the phone. My wife, she sounded very distressed. And she asked me, "Are you sitting down?" And before I could answer, of course, I thought something terrible must have happened, maybe something to my mother or my father or her mother. Before I could answer, she said to me, "Aryeh, our son Shmuel was killed this morning in Jenin." And I want to tell you what happened. Before, I want to introduce a certain point for thought, food for thought. I want to ask two questions, one halachic question. We have a concept which is called Ilui Neshama. Ilui Neshama, I guess we would translate it as an ascent of the soul. Something that we do for the good of the soul who is in Olam Haba. What do we mean by Ilui Neshama? How do we affect another person's soul? The second question is in Hilchot Avelut, the beginning of Siman Shin Dalet Mem. The Shulchan Aruch says as follows: Mitzvah gedola lahaspid al hamet kira'ui. There's a big mitzvah to eulogize the person who has passed away as is fitting. Umitzvato, and part of the mitzvah is shiarim kolo lomar alav dvarim ha-meshabrim et halev, for the person who is giving the eulogy to raise his voice and say things that break the heart, that cause people to cry. L'harbot, k'di l'harbot b'chia. U'l'hazkir shivcho. And to mention shevach, the good attributes, the good deeds of the nifter. V'asur l'haflig b'shivcho yoter midai. It is forbidden to exaggerate too much when telling his good points. Ella maskirim midot tovot shabo. You should the person who's eulogizing should mention those good attributes which he had. Umosifin behen tiksat, and to add just a little bit more. If he was a masmid, so the person who's eulogizing should say he was a big masmid. Add just a little bit. The question, of course, is, isn't this shekir? Isn't this lying? And we know that what the Torah teaches us as far as lying, midavar shekir tircha. Not only should we not lie, we should remove ourselves, be as far removed from shekir as possible. So why is Rav Yosef Karo, why is the Mechaber of the Shulchan Aruch saying, add a little bit? Isn't he asking us to lie? Okay. The answer is as follows. When we are born, when a neshama comes into this world, every neshama has godly light inside of it. Every neshama is on a godly mission to this world to add something, to rectify something, to change something in this world. The more the neshama, the more we fulfill this mission, the more we realize this goal, in the afterlife, the closer we can come to Ribono Shel Olam, the higher up we can ascend. This light inside of the neshama, this potential for good inside of the neshama, is the source of all the good deeds that a person does. This light inside of the neshama, which pushes us to goodness, to godliness, this light is always much greater than anything we can do. Our actions, as good as they are, can never fully express the potential of this light. When we see someone who in their life did good things, we know that inside of him, the potential for good was much larger. When Rav Yosef Karo, when the Mechaber says, add on a little, he's not saying to lie. He's saying to direct your thoughts not to the external actions of the person, but to that which was to the kernel of truth, of godliness, which was found inside of him, which led to all of his actions. Ilui neshama, to help the soul continue in its ascent. If we understand what that soul was trying to do in this world, and we continue through this, through the influence of that soul upon us, through our understanding, through our connection with that soul, and we continue to do what that soul tried to do in this world, then we are continuing the light of that soul, and that soul continues to ascend. Ba'olam ha'emet, in the world of truth. My son, Shmuel, he was 19 years old when he was killed, a little less than 20, he was 2 months short of 20. And there was a light inside of him. And I would like you to try and listen to the story and see what you understand of this light, and see what can you take from this light into your own lives to help his soul continue to ascend in the world to come. Okay, the story of Shmuel starts, I'm not going to tell you the whole story, starts with, of course, when he was born almost 30 years ago. There is much and much I can tell you about him as a child. He was our fourth son, the fourth child of nine children, Bli Ayin Hara. He was a very beautiful boy. He had blonde hair, blonde curly hair, blue eyes. He was very sweet. He was also very normal. He didn't always like to go to school. He loved his brothers and sisters, but he also argued with them sometimes, fought with them sometimes. I remember once one of his sisters took one of his books. He loved reading. There were several things that he loved. He loved reading, he loved learning Torah, he loved going on tiulim, and he loved music. He was very musical. So one time one of his sisters took one of the books that he was reading. I remember how he admonished her. Okay. He was a very normal boy, beautiful boy. He was very sweet, like I said. He was very enthusiastic. When he was younger, I was teaching in the yeshiva here at Arba. And part of my job as teaching meant being with the boys of the yeshiva on Shabbat, for Sudot Shabbat, I would give a Devar Torah to the Sudah. And I would usually start the Devar Torah with a question. And sometimes, there were 120 or 130 boys in the yeshiva, and I'm standing there, and I'm developing the question. And when I finish the question, looking towards the boys, and here's my young son, Shmuel, all of a sudden he got to go, Abba, Abba, I know the answer. And he did this several times. He was very sweet, very innocent, very enthusiastic. When he was about 8 years old, he learned to play the trumpet. When he was younger, he was very short, so the trumpet that he played was almost as large as he was. There's one more thing I want to tell you about him before I go on, is that he had one of his attributes, one of his midot was that he, even when he fell, he would get up and he would continue. Every summer I would take the boys horseback riding. And I usually wouldn't let them start getting on the horse until they were at least 8 years old. Shmuel was very athletic, very, very subtle. When he was 6 years old, he wanted to go riding on the horses already. So I said, well, we'll give him a chance. He got on the horse very nicely. I showed him how to sit, how to hold the reins, how to control the horse. He was doing very well. At a certain point along the path, he lost control of the horse. The horse bucked and threw him off. Shmuel fell down, rolled in the ground, got up on his feet, dusted himself off, and climbed back on the horse. That was Shmuel. Climbing back on the horse. For high school, he went to Yerushalayim. There's a yeshiva, it's called Yeshiva Letzirim, next to Merkaz Sarav. And he was also there, very enthusiastic. I remember coming to study with him once a week in the evening, and he would always be waiting for me impatiently. Abba, I have this problem with the sugya here. Can you explain it to me? Can you help me understand? When he finished high school, he decided to go to the Yeshiva Hesder at Eilat. And he told me, why Eilat? First of all, he said when he went to check out various yeshivot, he was very impressed with the shiur in Gemara to shiur Aleph in Eilat. He thought he can grow through that shiur. And also he said, as long as I'm going to be in the yeshiva, if the yeshiva itself contributes to the community, that's for me. That's an idea that I like. So he went to Eilat and he came back during Elul, he came back, and I asked him how it was, and it was great, and we talked about various sugyot that he had studied, and then he went back for a brief period of time, and much to my surprise, After Sukkot, he came back home and he told me, Abba, I'm leaving the yeshiva and I'm going to the army. And of course, I was very disappointed. I have to tell my weaknesses. I was very disappointed. I said, Shmuel, you said it was going so well for you. Why are you leaving? He was very honest. And he said to me, Abba, I feel that I'm putting into my studies in the yeshiva 80%, maybe 85%. But there are boys my age who are going into the army, endangering some of the army. You have to give 100%. I cannot allow myself, my conscience will not allow me to sit in the yeshiva if I can't give 100%. So I said to him, Shmuel, why didn't you at least tell me? Why don't you discuss with me? So he said, Abba, I know what you would tell me. And I want it, and I'm not staying in the yeshiva. His draft date wasn't until March. This was in November, so he had several months. And he went to study in the yeshiva in Yerushalayim in the meantime and do some work. He had a friend who was studying in Merkaz Harav, so they studied Masechet Yevamot. In March 2001, he went into the army. He went into the Golani Brigade. At that time, one of his older brothers was also in the Golani Brigade. We had two sons at the same time in the Golani Brigade. And he went and did what they do in the army. At a certain point, they sent him to learn how to be a medic. And then he went back to his unit after the medical course. And this continued. Now, there's something that I'm not sure I fully understand, but I have to explain this to you. In the army, there are two stages. The first stage is called Maslul, and this lasts in Golani for 10 months. 11 months. And then after the Maslul, you go to your regular job in the army, fighting wherever you're supposed to, or wherever you're going to be. So when Shmuel finished the Maslul, his commanding officers decided to send him to an older group. Now, why am I telling you this? Because a young soldier, he was one of four young soldiers being sent to this older group. You're all, Baruch Hashem, Bachurei Yeshiva, and in the Yeshiva, everyone, even those people who have the most work to do on their midot, everyone is very gentle, comparatively. Everyone is very good. I mean, maybe someone gets a little angry, but in the army, you have a lot of very, very tough situations, a lot of big challenges for your midot. So to be a younger soldier, 2 years younger, 2 years behind all of the rest of the soldiers, it's not always an easy position. If they look for someone to do an extra guard duty or someone to do an extra kitchen duty, so it's always the younger soldiers who do it. To make a long story short, he didn't want to do it, but this is what his commanding officer told him to do. He was very, very upset. I mentioned before he played the trumpet. We didn't own a trumpet. When one of his older brothers heard that Shmuel was very upset, he bought him a trumpet. Shmuel never saw the trumpet. Shmuel was killed before he could see it. The last time we saw Shmuel was on Pesach, Tavshin Samach Bet. He was with us for Leila Seder. What was going on in the country, in Israel, in 2002, in April of 2002? This was after the Oslo Accords. And there was a tremendous wave of brutal terrorism. There were many, many people killed. When Shmuel came home for Leila Seder, he told us that his commanding officer had told him to leave his cell phone on because he might be called up during the course of the Chag. And of course, he gave me this wicked grin. He said, "Abba, I forgot to leave my cell phone on." That's that Pesach. In a place in Netanya called the Park Hotel. 250 Jews, innocent Jews, gathered together to celebrate Pesach. Amongst them, a group of Holocaust survivors. In the middle of the Seder, a suicide bomber walked into the room where the Seder was being held and blew himself up. 29 people were killed, al makom. 140 injured, many of them critically. 3 more died in the course of the coming weeks. This was the last straw for the Israeli government. And there was a decision made to attack the centers of terrorism in cities such as Jenin, Shechem, Ramallah. Of course, we heard the news about the suicide bombing in the morning after Tfilah, and Shmuel understood that he would be called up right after Chag was out. Shmuel packed his bags, he had a ride, he called up his commanding officer, he had to go to a place called Beit El, and there he was supposed to meet the rest of his unit. By the time he got to Beit El, his unit had already left and gone into Ramallah. This was on a Friday. Thursday night he had left us. On a Friday, he missed his unit. He stayed in Beit El for Shabbat. During the fighting in Ramallah, a soldier, a friend of his from his unit, was killed. One of his officers was wounded. The last day of Pesach, Shvi'i Shel Pesach, Tafshin Samach Bet, part of the Golani Brigade entered into Jenin, together with a large number of forces, of Israeli forces, to clear out the terrorist infrastructure and the terrorists themselves from Jenin. The fighting was intense from house to house. The commander of the battalion, my son was part of the 51st Battalion, Gdut 51, and he was the medic of his platoon. The commander of the battalion is a man named Ofrik Buchris. And this I've heard from many soldiers who were in Jenin. Ofrik would get on the radio and he would encourage his soldiers. And you know what he would say to them? He would say, "You are the sons of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You will win. You are better than them. You are more righteous than them. You are more holy than them. You will win." There were, like I said, there were other units in Jenin at the same time. I've heard this from soldiers who were in other units. They all would go to the radio wave that was the Golani wave to listen to Ofrik Buchris encouraging his soldiers. "Remember," he would tell his soldiers, "you are the sons of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Remember who you are." The fighting, like I said, was very, very intense. There were men in Shmuel's unit who were killed and wounded. The fighting was from house to house. The platoon sometimes would advance 100 meters, 100 yards a day. On the morning of Chaf Vav Nisan, early in the morning, with sunrise, the evening before, the platoon had taken over a house, and they had planned what they're going to be doing the next day. Early in the morning of Chaf Vav, they went out into the courtyard under this house. The courtyard was surrounded by a wall, and the platoon commander, a man named Yitzchak Zini from Ashdod, he went out with another soldier into an alleyway, Matanya Robinson from Kibbutz Teretz Tzvi. He went out into the alleyway to do some reconnaissance, to see where the next house was that they were going to take over, what the next goal was. On their way out from the courtyard into the alley, they got entangled in some fishing line. And they thought it was just a piece of garbage. But it turned out later that this wire was connected to a building, to a room overlooking the alleyway. It was connected to some tin cans in that room, and it gave the Arabs warning that the Jewish soldiers were going into the alleyway. Yitzchak Zini and Matanya Robinson had advanced in the alleyway 200 meters, 150 meters, when the Arabs opened fire on them. Rifles, grenades, bombs. Yitzchak Zini right away understood what the Arabs were trying to do. They were trying to draw out the force from the courtyard in order to cut them off from any route of retreat. And Yitzchak gave Matanya an order to return to the courtyard. Running back to the courtyard, Matanya was wounded. Now there's in the army, when a soldier is wounded, they train the other soldiers to act as follows. If you see a soldier who was wounded, was fallen, you scream as loud as you can. War is very noisy. Bullets whistling by, grenades exploding. It's very confusing. So you scream, medic, medic, patsua, patsua. In English, it's wounded, wounded. And you can keep screaming until someone comes and takes care of the wounded man. The soldiers shouted, Chovesh, Chovesh, Patsua, Patsua. And Shmuel, who was in the courtyard, started tightening up. He had a special a special vest, which is given to the medics with his medical equipment. He started tightening it up, putting on his helmet so that he can go out to the alleyway to treat Matanya. As he was tightening up his vest, Yitzchak Zini, the commanding officer, screamed out, Weiss, stay in the courtyard. Afterwards, when I talked to Yitzchak Zini, he said, I wanted the other soldiers to bring Matanya into the courtyard, and I wanted that in the safety of the courtyard, Shmuel should take care of Matanya. Another soldier, a boy by the name of Kobi Chazan, started to go out. But this was Shmuel's responsibility. Shmuel's very, very responsible. Shmuel grabbed Kobi Chazan by his shirt and pushed him against the wall and ran out into the alleyway. He ran maybe 30 meters before he was cut down. Now I want you to think for a minute what Shmuel did. Going out under fire, after someone has already been hit by this fire, going out, putting himself in danger, facing death. And this, after his commanding officer told him not to go out. Did he do the right thing? Should he have listened to his commanding officer? The army thinks he did the right thing because the army awarded him a medal. In Israel, it's called a tzalash, tziyun l'shevach, after death, for what he did. He volunteered under death, under facing death, he volunteered to try and save Matanya Robinson. Where does the strength come from? I sometimes think to myself, would I have had the courage to run out like that? Being given an order not to go out, having every excuse in the world not to go out. Someone already started running out, somebody else started running out, I have to push them aside in order to claim the zchut to go out. Tell you another story. Okay. Shmuel was killed the day before Yom HaShoah. His funeral is Yom HaShoah. And this isn't only simli, it's not only symbolic, it's very real. My family, my immediate family, my mother, my father, were not touched by the Shoah. My wife's family, on the other hand, was terribly touched by the Shoah. My wife's father, Baruch Kahana, Alav Shalom, was from a place in Europe called Karpo Rus. He was a part of a large family, Hasidic family, Hasidut, Zinichov. He was one of 16 children. He was the second youngest of 16 children. The basic family, mother, father, children and grandchildren, spouses and grandchildren, numbered 84 people. Can you imagine how many survived the Shoah? 6 survived the Shoah. 2, my father-in-law and his older brother had run away from home to come to Israel. I remember being with my father-in-law in Tisha B'Av one year, how he cried. And he told me, I'm crying for the Chorban, but part of the Chorban is the Chorban of my family. He said to me, Ari, do you know, I never said goodbye to my father. I never had the chance to say goodbye to my father. My wife eulogized Shmuel at his funeral in Yom HaShoah. And she said something that I didn't know. She told me that when she was younger, she had promised herself that she would have, God granted, as large a family as possible. And this was her way of fighting the Germans back. That was on my wife's mother's side. The story is much more complicated, much more heroic, much more tragic. My wife's grandfather on her mother's side was a man named Yitzchak Knoller, born in Germany, born and raised in Germany. He had been a small businessman, very, very astute, very brave. Before Hitler came to power, he understood what was happening in Germany, and he took his family and moved to Amsterdam. I want to tell you the story for two reasons. Three reasons. One, that's a very touching story in of itself. The second reason is that the Shoah is not disconnected from what happened in Jenin. Third, this was Shmuel's great-grandfather. This is where his strength came from his family. Izzy Knoller, Yitzhak Knoller, when the Germans invaded Amsterdam, took his family. He wanted to get to Switzerland. He took his family to Belgium, to Brussels, from Amsterdam. Maybe I'll describe just a minute what was happening in Amsterdam at that time during the war. After the Germans conquered Holland, they made certain decrees to limit the movement of Jews in Amsterdam. One, it was forbidden for a Jew to ride in public transportation. Trains, buses were forbidden, were off limits to Jews. Two, a Jew could not be outside from 8 o'clock at night till 8 o'clock in the morning. Three, every Jew had to have a yellow patch on his outer clothing, readily seeable. And a Jew who was caught without this patch, what was his punishment? I don't know. Death. Immediate. No trial. Izzy Knoller, Yitzhak Knoller, took his family on a Monday, on a morning, without the yellow patches. They boarded a train, headed for the Belgian border, got off the train before the border where they met someone who was supposed to take them across the border. And the person told them, go back. Because the border is sealed hermetically. The Germans are searching every nook and cranny of the border. The family went back to Amsterdam and a month later tried again. And this time they made it across into Belgium. And they rented an apartment in Brussels. And then they continued on their way. It's a long story. To make a long story short, they continued on their way through all sorts of trials and tribulations, through France, in the dead of the winter, in the cold of the winter, until they finally arrived at night at the Swiss border. And we all know how enlightened the Swiss are. I'm being cynical. The Swiss border patrols grabbed them, found them, and told them, we're not letting you enter Switzerland. Not only are we not letting you enter, we're going to put you back out on the road where you came from. Yitzhak Knoller pleaded with him. He said, okay, I understand you don't want Jews in Switzerland. Give us an hour. Give us 2 hours. Let's warm up a little bit. Let's drink something warm. Let's rest just for a few minutes. No. Not only that, the Swiss border guards told them they're going to wait for a German patrol and they're going to put them on the road when they see the German patrol coming. They're not going to give them to the hands of the German patrol, but they're going to put them on the road when they see the German patrol coming. So here they are, eight Jews, standing in the middle of a road in France on the Swiss border, a German patrol coming down the road. What can they do? They realized that if they would start to run, they would only draw attention to them. So what did they do? They laid down beside the road. praying. And God performed the miracle. They didn't realize what day it was. It was the 25th of December. And all the German guards in the patrol were roaring drunk. And the patrol passed them by. They were able to go back through France into Belgium, back to Brussels, where they hid out for the rest of the war. Now, Yitzhak Knoller wasn't one just to sit by and wait for things to happen. When he got back to Brussels, he joined up with the Belgian underground and fought the Germans as best he could. The war ended. Brussels was liberated, as were the camps. And Yitzhak Knoller and his wife Lily wanted nothing more than to come to Israel. But they couldn't. Yitzhak Knoller wrote in his diary, he saw thousands, hundreds, maybe thousands of Jewish children, orphans, parents killed. These children, some of them were saved by Christian families, some of them even brought up as Christians. He said, he wrote down in his diary, he said to himself, how can I go? How can I think of myself now and go to Israel? Who is going to take care of these children? Him and his wife set up an orphanage, a religious orphanage, in a place called Marken in Belgium. And they saved hundreds of Jewish children. They were at the orphanage for 3 years, from 1945 to 1948. Then finally someone came from Israel to replace them, to continue running the orphanage, and at long last they were able to go on Aliyah. They came to Israel in March of 1948. In April of 1948, Yitzhak Knoller's oldest son, Eliezer, was killed in a place called Atarot in fighting against the Arabs. Yitzhak Knoller made a speech in his Beit Knesset following the declaration of the state. This was after his son was killed. After all he had gone through in Europe. And in his speech he said, do we think that anyone is going to give us our independence on a tray of silver? We are going to have to fight for our home. We are going to have to suffer losses for our people. In May of 1948, after all that Yitzhak Knoller went through, and all the sacrifices that he made for his people, Yitzhak Knoller was killed when the Egyptians bombed the central bus station in Tel Aviv. This was Shmuel's grandfather. The message that we as a family got from Yitzhak Knoller was, we have to give. We have to be willing to sacrifice. Tov, I want to add two more points, okay? After Shmuel was killed, I had three of my sons signed up to join combat units in the Israeli army. Now, the law in the country is that any boy who had a relative who was killed, a brother who was killed, doesn't have to join a combat unit. It's all volunteer. Not only three of my sons, one of them even went into the Golani Brigade. Shmuel's closest friend, the boy that he studied Masechet Yevamot with, a boy named Amichai Merchavia, also who was studying at that time in Yeshivat Merkas Harav, also decided to close his books and go join the army. Amichai Merchavia joined the Golani Brigade, became an officer in the brigade. And 4 years after Shmuel was killed, Amichai Merchavia was killed in the Second Lebanon War in a place called Din Shapira. 2 years ago, another close friend of Shmuel, a boy by the name of Yoni Netanel, was killed in Aza, another boy from his class. 2 years ago also, the officer who was able to take Shmuel's body out of that alleyway, a man by the name of Eliraz Peretz, was killed in Aza. Every one of us has something that we can give. Every one of us has a responsibility to give, even to the point of sacrifice, even to the point of self-sacrifice, even to the point of death. It's important for me to say this to you. You've come to Israel for a year, some for more, some for 2 years. Bezrat Hashem, to study Torah. There is nothing in the world more important than studying Torah. There is nothing holier. There is nothing more beautiful. There is nothing that gives more strength to our people than sons of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov who sit and study Gemara. Nothing. You know, it's not easy. I was a yeshiva student myself once. It's not always easy. Sometimes the sugyot are hard. Sometimes our heads might be in other places. Give it one more push. Get up one more time. 5 more minutes. After Shmuel was killed, I took upon myself, Bli Neger, every day. At the end of the day, no matter what I've studied during the day or don't study, haven't studied during the day, I learn one last Mishnah. It could be 3 o'clock in the morning. I could be on my last leg. One more Mishnah. One more Mishnah. One more Tosfot. One more Rashi. One more push. I'd like you to think about it. I'd like you to take what you can from Shmuel's bravery and Shmuel's self-sacrifice. And I'd like you to try and continue his light into your own lives. Thank you very much for listening.
Question.